Karen, come on up.
All right, our final presentation is looking at the relationships between media use and obesity with a good group from, I think all of you are from the Education Development Center.
That's right. Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm Deborah McLean-Liao, and we'll be presenting on behalf of our team. And we'll look at the relationship between media use, obesity, among youth living in high poverty settings. I should say there are no relationships to disclose. So to begin with, research suggests that increases in youth screen time have occurred across the socioeconomic spectrum as new digital media and mobile communication devices have become widely available. And because media use frequently involves sedentary activity, this trend has important health implications, particularly in poor communities where obesity rates are higher and access to safe recreational opportunities is limited. Research also tells us that there is a link between obesity and early pubertal development, sexual initiation, that is early sexual initiation, and reproductive health, especially among young women. But interestingly, increased media attention to obesity and efforts to counter obesity may negatively impact the positive body image perceptions often reported by Black girls and women. And the other interesting thing here is that while adolescent Black males are not as likely to be obese as females, their physical and mental health may also be affected either by overweight or underweight. And so to address these issues, we received a two-year supplement to augment a Healthy Futures longitudinal study, which is a multi-year parent education intervention spanning 6th through 10th grades. So what is the Healthy Futures Project? Healthy Futures aims to reduce adolescent risk behaviors that contribute to the HIV/AIDS epidemic and other health disparities among African American and other Black youth living in high poverty neighborhoods in New York City. And in this case, our work takes place in Brooklyn, New York. The intervention supports positive parenting practices, including parent-child communication, monitoring, parental rule setting, and the parental disapproval of risk behaviors. It also addresses developmental changes and the health challenges that sons and daughters face during that sticky period between early adolescence through their entry into high school. And if any of you have young folk that fall into that age group, you know what we're talking about here. The obesity supplement addresses not only pubertal development and sexual reproductive health, but also their interconnectedness with youth's body images, nutrition, and exercise. So we conducted surveys using the supplement with a subsample of 9th and 10th graders in high poverty sections of New York City. I mentioned Brooklyn already. About 87% of our sample were Black, and items assessed height, weight, daily TV or video viewing, past day digital media consumption, and that includes computer games, texting, social media, online videos, downloading music. And then self-reported height and weight use were used to compute the age and sex-adjusted body mass index. And so we used multivariate analysis to examine the associations between media use and obesity, controlling for demographics, physical activity, and dietary variables. And what we found is that over half of the participants reported watching TV videos on a television or a computer for 4 or more hours per day, and that during the past day, 41% reported using social media websites for 3 or more hours, and 45% reported texting, chatting online for 3 or more hours. And about 14% were obese. And so based on these multivariate analysis, youth reporting high levels of online media use were twice as likely to be obese than those who did not, And youths spend a significant percentage or proportion of their day using online media, and this was also associated with being obese. So these findings to us stress the need to come up with some sort of intervention which could reduce teen media use as a means of addressing obesity. And so in our research, we found that parents have an impact on youth behavior. Whether consciously or unconsciously, parents play a major role in shaping their adolescents' behaviors. However, the challenge with doing parenting interventions is that, you know, we find that the changing structure of families, employment challenges, poverty, all of these things place constraints on parents' ability to take part in programs, any number of parenting programs that require intensive involvement, whether they be group or events or workshops, etc. And this is particularly true in the communities where we did this work, in which only about a third of the adolescents live with both parents, and many families are just basically stressed by the demands of parenting and underemployment and trying to make ends meet. And so in response to these findings about the link between obesity and media consumption, we developed a parent-mediated intervention called Keeping Our Families Healthy. And so what is this? It is a theoretically based audio CD intervention for parents that use developmentally and gender-appropriate dramatic vignettes. All of that to say, we developed audio CDs that were pretty darn good. The CDs deliver culturally tailored audio stories that basically these stories model positive parenting practices to support healthy development, positive body images, healthy eating, and exercise. And these stories underscore a few important things. The importance of family support, including countering any stigma related to weight for youth as well as adolescent. These stories model culturally and gender relevant strategies that parents can use to support attitudes and behaviors associated with healthy bodies, healthy development, nutrition, exercise. And the stories also identify strategies parents can use to decrease media use, including doing things like rule setting, how much time can be spent with media, and encouraging and engaging in physical activity with their children. In our previous research, audio CDs were found to be highly acceptable among parents in the Healthy Future study because they're brief, low intensive, they don't require a lot of parents. They're easy to disseminate. They could be disseminated by CD or MP3 or online. And parents can access them pretty much anywhere, you know, in the kitchen, in the car, on the phone. Parents can also listen at any time that's convenient to them. So this intervention approach, this audio CD intervention approach, encourages the use of teachable moments in everyday life. And so Keeping Our Families Healthy CD contains a series of 8 stories centered around fictional families that represent diverse family structures, including single-parent households and households led by a grandparent. And so I show you here an example of a story, track 1 of the CD, where we meet the Green family at a family gathering, where Monique Green learns that her sister Melinda has diabetes. And Melinda is trying to change her and her family's diet and exercise habits, but she's finding that it's a challenge. And Monique supports her sister and says she's going to start making changes to her family as well. And so these parenting practices addressed here in this particular story include support, communication, modeling, etc. There are also some key messages embedded in each of the stories, messages that deal with knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors that are conducive to exercise and healthy eating and so forth. Okay, I guess I'll skip that slide. Doesn't want to go back. So the slide that you don't see here also has 2 stories which really deal with the issue of exercise among teens. One is the story of Danielle and her, the mom Danielle and her daughter Shauna, and the mother basically finds out that her daughter's been missing gym class, and after really inquiring with the daughter about why she's missing gym class for 2 weeks, the daughter eventually says, Shauna eventually admits that she doesn't feel comfortable getting changed in front of the other girls. So she has some body image issues going on. And then later in the story, in one of the later stories, there's a story called I Know You Love to Dance. So in this story, the mom encourages her daughter to get more exercise and find creative ways to do stuff indoors. All of these stories were developed using a community-based formative process, including focus groups and a community advisory board to ensure cultural and gender relevance. And in each of our CDs that we've developed, including Keeping Our Families Healthy, we've identified well-known and well-liked narrators, and here you see we've used Angela Bassett, John Amos, and Andre Brower. So I want to say that these CDs, such as the ones that I've mentioned, you know, they're distributed over the course of a year to families, and the results from our studies and our previous studies show that these low-intensity, low-demand interventions have a positive impact on reducing preteen risk behaviors at 3 months and later follow-up. We also found that the audio approach was acceptable to large proportions of parents, with the feedback from parents being overwhelmingly positive about their ability to use these CDs. So with that said, I want to acknowledge a few groups here. First, our Healthy Futures Project staff, the families and staff from New York City Public Schools, and this work was funded by a grant from the NIH. Thank you for your time.
Like all of our presenters, if I can get all the presenters to come up here or a representative from the team so that we can take some questions from the audience. And while we're making our way, I just want to remind everyone that the Health Communication Working Group business meeting is tonight from 6:30 to 8 p.m. in room 206B, so just a little bit down the hall, and we welcome all new members. Do you have any questions?
Hi, my name is Erin Dillon, and I work with the Cambridge Public Health Department, and my question is for Mary Ellen. Great presentation, by the way. And I noticed in one of the clips that the young woman said that she and her friend quit tanning for a year and then started up again. Number one, is that something you hear often? And then number two,
excellent questions. We did some research on a different aspect of our program in the schools where we use appearance-motivated techniques, UV reflectance photography, and what we learned even in that study, which is not a surprise, is that kids need to get constant reinforcements. So what we took from the piece with Glenna talking about that she knew somebody directly who died of melanoma, and it scared them enough to stop, but they restarted, speaks to the importance of giving constant reinforcement, as we all know. And for me in skin cancer education, I know that we're not going to make a difference in this disease. One person dies every 45 minutes from skin cancer in the United States, and it's preventable and easily recognizable, and every year that goes up. It's not until the public health and medicine and education all come on board. So do these kids get the messages? Not necessarily. We go back to the schools every year. Sometimes we get a buzz going in the schools because of it. One school, they did many different aspects. SAD got involved in because students against destructive decisions. Tanning is a destructive decision, so one SAD chapter picked it up, but it varies from school to school.
For me? Yes, for you. Nice presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah. And from an environmental health perspective, there is an issue of alternatives not always being safe until we have a better sense of what's in there. There's a lot of research that shows endocrine disruptors in personal care products. So has any research been done in terms
Excellent question. So there are endocrine disruptors in sunscreens, and the environmental working group has a list of sunscreens, and you can look at that. My understanding from what I have read about the selfless tanning products, the are sugars, and it's the same ingredient that's used in beer to make beer brown. And what it actually does is dyes the dead cells on top of our skin. So from what I understand, it's not absorbed and is fairly safe. One of the big concerns in dermatology is people think that it protects them then against UV rays, and they get sunburned because they don't realize that it's just dyeing their dead cells brown. You're welcome.
Indirect promotion, I suspect so, but you know, it's just exploratory stuff.
Question to that, because you bring up a lot of interesting issues, and this is just about methodology. Any things learned the hard way or best practices to share in doing a content analysis from YouTube? Because with newspapers, you can get them, they're neat, easy to do. You know, I saw, you know, on the slide the issue of things can be taken down, the issues of who is the real author. Any tips or best practices to share with us?
I think for us, again, most of my research is quantitative. This is my first quantitative research study, and so it was. I learned a lot, and I would say that for us, luckily, we had a really good guide. We have some colleagues at the American Literacy Foundation, Amanda Richardson, and Jennifer Cantrell. We read their work. I talked with them when I received funding for this study. That really provided a great guide for our initial, exploration of videos. So That's how we started. So we have a guide. But I know that I was overambitious because it takes a lot of time. I really under budget. I'm so grateful that we were able to share our data, it takes a lot of time, a lot of work, and a lot of resources. So.
Mm-hmm.
to go through IRB approval to access those children's
absolutely.
So
yes.
Who did you go through?
Department of Education.
And did you have to get consents and assents from every child in that study?
Okay.
So did you find getting consent from the parents an issue in terms of the participants? Because we did a study in Quincy, and in one of the schools we only got 33% of the kids participating because the school nurses couldn't get the consent from the parents.
Yeah, no, you know, we have this track record of working in schools over multiple years, and so didn't really have that issue.
And are the materials that have come out of the project available for public distribution?
They are available online to be purchased, and then we're working on moving the, because audio CDs are obsolete for some part of the population, but in the community that we work, not quite. You'd be surprised how many people are still using them. But we're looking at moving those stories online so that they could be found within an access.
Or now they're available.
Largely African American Latino, and within the African American population, you know, there are Caribbean, a large percentage of people who families who are from the Caribbean, and a smaller percentage from the African diaspora. And I don't have the stats with me, but I certainly can get the information more detailed to you.
Okay.
Focusing on the papers the way we did, but I think our hope is that even if on those cigar brands for almost a decade. And in Atlanta, every year they have this event called
Coachella.
And so actually, Dr. Kimberly Landrum Sterling, who is my colleague at Georgia State, we actually just we have a paper in press now where we where she highlighted was, you know, how they actually went to that event about 2 years ago. She and her GRAs, and they did a, you know, survey, minister survey, and they went to see how the main question was, you know, when you compare different types of endorsements, is it a celebrity endorsed, or in comparison to just like a nobody mm-hmm. endorsed, you know, is it, you know, how is that linked to use of tobacco products? And so obviously, you know, with African Americans who was heavily attended then, that, you know, the results indicated that they were more likely to be a celebrity endorsement. So with Snoop Dogg, you know, owning his own executive, Cigarillo, you know, it was just a declare. So I think, you know, obviously I'm thinking about interventions, you know, on how do we address it, given that, you know, minority African American kids, they smoke at lower rates when they're young, and during adolescence, from cigarette smoking. So what's going on in the trajectory across, you know, young adolescents, later adolescents, you know, adults, where they are smoking the alternate products and hydrate, you know, are suggested based on our limited focus. So I'm just, my question is, how do you get these celebrities involved? Yeah, like Angela Bassett, and, you know, that's appealing to,
The use of celebrities, I think, is a somewhat controversial issue because their endorsement can either work for your cause or against it, right? I mean, so in the issue of Snoop Dogg, for instance, mm-hmm. having his own line and his lifestyle, you know, actually promotes and supports pro-tobacco use among youth, right? And so we often grapple with who do we get and how do we do that? And so, you know, we use this formative process where we ask the community, and then we, you know, we vet. I mean, focus groups and our community advisory board, they recommend celebrities that they'd like to see, and parents are pretty discerning about whom they'd like to see as a spokesperson or as a model or so I mean it's as simple as, in terms of, to answer your question, for us as simple as calling their agents. You know, reaching out to the agent of the celebrity and, you know, making your case, and we've gotten all of these celebrities for little or nothing. Some of them with pro bono, and others, like $1,000 or something. So it's pretty
straightforward.
Thank you. Can I build on that?
Yeah.
I think the beauty of what you guys have done, the Healthy Futures work, is that it's not necessarily seen as a celebrity endorsement either. The celebrities are narrating the audio file, and their picture goes on the CD. But it's not like we're using that as the endorsement of our product, which I think can be different. It's sort of a different twist on, you know, sort of somebody endorsing a particular intervention. So I think you have to think about them a little bit differently.
Yeah, and actually, and I realized that. I did, but I guess what I'm trying to think about is like future intervention programs mm-hmm. to, you know, just change this. Let's talk about it. So I'm thinking, you know, hey, that's going to get another rapper. You know, someone to, I mean, because bottom line, these young adults, and typically, you know, are targeting someone males, you know, young adults. They like a rap. I mean, they like, that's the music they like, and they're using on YouTube or whatever. So, but, you know, just saying rapper, you know.
Yeah. Another intervention we've actually used, hip hop artist Talib Kweli, with an intervention that we did for a young black male, 18 to 25, who really resonates with a hip hop artist. He was from the same community, and he was the narrator for this computer generated brief intervention that we developed. So, and it's interesting, while it's not an endorsement, indirectly, the image of that celebrity speaks to the population. So yeah, they're narrators and they're guides, but they're not officially endorsed.
I know what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question for Mary Ellen.
Yep.
I'm just curious, whether or not in the videos you share with the students that ultimately the girl passes away, and how did you come to that decision as to whether to include that or not?
When we initially did the video, the cinematographer recommended that we share Glennon's story with them, but they did not know what the video was going to be about. They were recruited to be part of a health discussion, so we had them in the library, and we did three different groups that day. And we decided to keep that in because we wanted to see that impact. Does that make a difference if they get to know somebody who's died of this disease? And Glennon even spoke about she coming to know someone who died of the disease. So we put it in to look at the impact. And I must tell you, and we changed this video so many times, and I sat in the classroom while kids watched it. And before we put Glennon's name underneath her 1 year later, the kids didn't even realize it was the same person. And they'd gasp, and they'd like, oh, that's the same person. So seeing her a year later with metastatic disease, and I'm an oncology nurse, I see this every day. I know this disease, and one of the reasons I got into it is because I see people die of skin cancer, which I think is a sin. So I, as an oncology nurse, I thought it was important to keep that in.
So, I'm sorry, I guess it's a follow-up question. I'm just curious, because I thought the video was super impactful, and I think it's a very interesting program. But then you get into the issue of the patient being treated for cancer, and where's this fine line of fear-based methodology?
And that's why we have many different components to it, because we also found that different things touch different kids. And as I said, by doing assessments with over 1,000 high school kids, the boys really liked to learn what melanoma looked like. And they would tell us that was the, where Glennon, it was the emotion, not the fact that she died as much as the emotion that it brought out in them, thinking about the fact that they tanned, because she goes on to talk about the impact on her family and all that. And they started thinking about it in terms of the impact of what they did on their families. So there were many different aspects, but we kept in what the kids thought was impactful. And we took out what was didn't. We didn't. We even moved things around. We didn't start the video initially with Glennon, but with their input, they said it's her story. Start with Glennon and open with it. And the big part was keeping the kids talking about the social issues. Some people thought that should come out, but that was what it was all about. The social reality is kids love to tan together, and they enjoy doing this. And so it needed to be there.
I didn't see the video, but can you comment on the relationship between showing her death and perceived risk or perceived harm of, you know, exposure to sun and melanoma? Because I, from my understanding of drug prevention research, for example, you know, showing those sort of images does lead to increased perception of harm or risk.
And again, there's an accompanying discussion guide to go with this. So they watch the video, and we allow them as peers to talk to each other. I mean, we've had kids say things in the classroom like, I opened my eyes in the tanning bed to see what I wasn't supposed to see. We teach kids about ocular melanoma. The second most common place that you get melanoma is in your eye. And people who indoor tan have an increased risk of that, 2,000 cases. So we really try to just open discussion. As you might not have heard this, but we really want them to come to their own decisions. I don't want to go in and tell them what to do. I want them to talk to each other, and they do. And they say, how could you do that? I mean, we had a kid in one school who got badly burnt in a machine because his 16-year-old classmate was the tanning bed operator. You learn these things from being in the school. And for in Massachusetts, for 8 years, we have not been able to pass an under-18 tanning ban. But from my discussions in the classroom, I realized the importance because kids do what kids do. They take risks in these beds, that so they should be protected, and we're not protecting children in Massachusetts under 18, although many other states have in the last couple of years. Yeah, we've been showing this at PTOs also. So we not only had parents involved in looking at it to start with, but we've been showing it at PTO programs. And I've watched this video thousands of times, and I hope you'll go back and watch it. We just did a fundraiser, and you could hear a pin drop. People are really touched by it, and the parents love it. And the parents say, I got to go home and have that discussion. You know, The second most common person that a kid starts tanning with is their mother. Yeah, we haven't done it with the two groups together. You know, that's often difficult. When we go to the schools, we say, we want to come in, but we'll do whatever works for you. Mm-hmm. And there aren't, I mean, I've done some programs that have been health fairs where parents come with kids, but we haven't done this with that, but it's a great idea.
Before I let you sit down, I just wanted to follow up with the idea of the fear pills, because there is that literature that says they work sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying with the differences between the boys really finding the mm-hmm. ABCDE is very
practical.
Very practical. So I think it'd be interesting to split it by sex and see if the results are different, because I don't know if you're familiar with, or the audience is familiar with, Kim Witte's extended parallel processing model tries to reconcile that fear appeal literature.
Mm-hmm.
And when fear appeals are effective is when the efficacy, so self-efficacy, response efficacy components of a campaign are really strong, which would be the ABCDE. So I wondered if you split it by sex, would boys gravitate more towards that? You would see maybe some of what it seems like you're expecting among females with almost that defensive avoidance happening.
Sometimes we did see that. Again, these things are a bell curve. So, I mean, we had some kids who would say, I will never stop indoor tanning. We know that there's a tanning addiction. That's been proven. There's research that shows that you can become addicted, as Glenna described in her piece. So, you know, again, what we're trying to do is to not give them all the answers, because we know that there's such disparity even in the classroom culturally, but we're trying to touch kids on different levels, and that's why we put different parts in it. And we are working on a Pinterest site so that we have alternatives that kids can go to. So we try to give them other places to get more information also.
Well, again, let's thank our presenters for a great session and great discussion.